Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. There's been a debate over free speech in recent weeks, amplified by an open letter on justice and open debate published online by Harper's Magazine. It was signed by well more than 100 notable cultural luminaries, artists, thinkers, and academics, including J.K. Rowling, Malcolm Gladwell, Noam Chomsky, and Deirdre McCloskey. The letter seems to take aim at the so-called cancel culture, positing that it's going too far. Here's a quote. "The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted, and censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture. An intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty." Close quote. The letter has sparked a far-reaching response with notable rebuttals and op-eds written in places like The Atlantic, The LA Times, other media outlets, and most notably an open letter in The Objective, which received many signatures from academics and journalists and criticizes the Harper's letter, saying it misses, quote, misses the point. The irony of the piece is that nowhere in it do the signatories mention how marginalized voices have been silenced for generations in journalism, academia, and publishing. Close quote. Joining us now to bring this conversation to you is Deirdre Nansen McCloskey, Distinguished Professor Emerita of Economics, History, and English and Communication at the University of Illinois Chicago, and author of many books, including most recently, Why Liberalism Works, How True Liberal Values Produce a Freer, More Equal, Prosperous World for All. Hello, Deirdre, and welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you, dear?
I'm doing well, thank you. And we also have with us Anthony L. Fisher, who's a politics columnist for Business Insider, who's written a few pieces on this subject. Hello, Anthony. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Myra Washington, who's an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of New Mexico and author of Blasian Invasion, Racial Mixing of the Celebrity Industrial Concept. Myra also got her PhD from the University of Illinois in Urbana and is one of the signatories of the Objective letter. Hello, Myra. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Deirdre McCloskey, I'm going to begin with you. Why did you sign this letter?
Well, I think it's innocuous. I of course completely agree that there have been many very badly marginalized, silenced groups in our society for a long time, and I'm solidly behind allowing them to say anything they want, as they are. I'm glad to see, but of course I'm not so enthusiastic about unreasonable aggression towards someone who, in a university class, says something that someone doesn't like. I mean, I think all three of us can agree that free expression is good, and it ought to be accorded to everyone.
You know, can I ask, in your view, what is, you know, so-called cancel culture? How does that manifest itself?
Well,
as you see,
no, I have to admit that I don't pay close attention to all this. I just learned the word cancel culture not long ago, and I think it can be. That is, the cancellation can be exaggerated. I don't mind if people call me names or say, oh, she's a jerk and so forth. That's okay. I think it goes too far when powerful people use it or respond to it too easily. That if someone doesn't like someone, shouldn't be a cause for suppressing their views.
Sure.
I think of the way the Times fired the editor who allowed a United States senator to write what I agree was a stupid column on the editorial page, but You know, if all columnists were checked for stupidity every day, we wouldn't have very many columns.
Myra, and of course you're referring to the James Bennett being fired as the editorial page editor of the New York Times. Myra, I want to bring you into the conversation now. What can you talk about your initial reaction to the Harper's letter and how you came to sign on to the rebuttal to that in The Objective?
Yeah, sure. I was just really surprised looking at the names that were signed to the Harper's letter, because I thought, well, that seemed to be really rich that these people who had engaged in the very things that they apparently were now deriding were signing on to it and asking for more civil discourse. And I think Deidre is right that cancel culture, whatever we call it, has always existed. But part of my reaction was that here are these people who are really immune from cancel culture. Like, none of them have had their jobs taken away. None of them have been placed in precarious positions. None of them have been, you know, sort of drummed out of their fields. And so I signed the rebuttal, even though I'm usually loath to sign, you know, super long and sort of open letters, because I thought that it was important for people to know that actually that's not what's happening here. And that there are other voices that are clamoring to be heard. And that is what these Harper's letter signatories were really responding to. They weren't canceled.
Yeah. And so I wonder, and this is, we've heard these different lines of critique here. Some of it is the sort of the company that's, you know, of the people who signed it, and the other, you know, and there have been objections of the actual content of the letter itself. Can you talk a little bit more about specifically what you take issue with in, you know, the letter itself?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when I was reading it and I was like, what, I had to ask myself, well, what seems to be the problem here? Because again, none of them had really faced any sort of consequences, and their platforms are huge, right? And so part of what really gets at the root of cancel culture is this thinking that somehow, because you're canceled, that you're deplatformed, that your livelihood has been taken away, which none of these people had experienced. And then again, looking through that list, so then I was like, okay, Carrie Nelson signs. So he wants more free speech, yet had no problem spearheading an entire campaign to make sure that the University of Illinois rescinded the job offer to Stephen Salida. And not just that Illinois rescinded the job offer, but that Salida was now just drummed out of academia. So he is no longer an academic, right? I think he said, you know, did an update where he was now driving buses for the school district in Virginia where he lives. And so I thought, here is where cancel culture has really come home to roost, is with the people who don't have power, with the people who have always been marginalized, with the people whose speech and free speech movements have always gone against the elites, the establishment, whatever we want to call it, dominant culture. Those are the people who have always been on the margins and who have been canceled. And who have been canceled without fanfare. They've been canceled without the JK Rowling Twitter followers list. They've been canceled without people taking up arms and, you know, sending out petitions. Every day I see people who are canceled by the very people who have signed this letter. And then I think to myself, what is going on here that they are taking the stance instead of really looking at themselves to be like, well, how do we perpetuate this thing where we're pushing out voices that we don't like, that we don't appreciate, that we don't want to hear from, who have never gotten to speak freely?
Yeah. Okay. This seems like a good opportunity to bring Anthony L. Fisher into the conversation. As I said, politics columnist for Business Insider. You've written a few pieces on this. And speaking of Salida and the overall Israeli-Palestinian conflict, something in your article really jumped out at me, which is that, and I think this is a quote, on one side, a person can claim to feel unsafe by a colleague's support of a brutal occupier state. On the other side, a person can claim to feel unsafe by a colleague's support of the anti-Semitic theocracy Hamas. So, Anthony, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how this dichotomy exists where, you know, people are talking about safety and trying to say like what speech is, you know, makes them feel unsafe and how that relates to these letters?
Yeah. think that, you know, again, I've written in those columns critically of the Harper's letter in some respects, which we can get into. But what I think was the basis of this kind of anodyne, vaguely written letter wasn't so much that everyone's being canceled left and right and that no speech should be considered beyond the pale, but it was more that an increasingly wide berth of topics that can't be discussed, that because there is a right answer and a wrong answer on everything related to those subjects, is there's a growing fervor for that in a lot of fields, including media and academia. And if the bar for acceptable speech in a workplace is I'm offended, then that's a tool that anyone can use. And it has been used by the right quite often. I mean, in the 1980s, it was much more the right that was using the sexual revolution and, you know, different forms of art to claim offense and to demand that these things be silenced.
And I guess arguably Colin Kaepernick is one of the more notable recent examples I've heard cited as someone who's been canceled by the right.
Yeah. I think there's a term that's the new PC is patriotic correctness. You know, from people from the right who are offended by a peaceful, nonviolent protest in the workplace. So, one thing I would, you know, say just to respond to the idea that nobody who had signed the Harper's letter had ever dealt with any consequences. Noam Chomsky, Gloria Steinem, Wynton Marsalis, just to name a few of the more prominent and wealthy signees, have all been censored at various points in their lives by, you know, governments and private businesses. Salman Rushdie had to live on the run because he offended a theocracy. Garry Kasparov lives under constant assassination threat for his speech. So there, you know, these are people who actually said, we're not really so much worried about ourselves, we'll be all right. It's more about keeping the lines of acceptable discourse as wide as they possibly can be for people who don't have power, for younger people. And one thing I found in the objective response that I completely agree with is that people of color, Black people, have been pushed off of journalistic assignments because of fears of their objectivity. I absolutely think that that's an unacceptable form of cancel culture, which is kind of an increasingly useless word, like a phrase, like just like political correctness, because it can mean so many different things. But to, you know, to bring it home, like one of the things I argued in both columns is that free speech has always been the best tool available for marginalized people, for oppressed people. Particularly the gay rights movement, which was unpopular for decades. You know, gay rights were not popular even up until the 90s. And it was only because speech was available that people could make their case, they could argue, they could persuade, and they could change minds. And I think that that's still the most important thing. Not that all speech should be considered equal or valuable or tolerated even. It should be that there should be as wide a berth as possible for discussion and argument. And we shouldn't ever really consider too many ideas completely solved for the rest of time.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about the debate over free speech and open debate and the idea of cancel culture, and framed by a couple of letters that have been published recently. We're speaking with Deidre Nansen McCloskey, who is a professor emerita from the University of Illinois Chicago, signed the letters that appeared in Harper's, sort of arguing against cancel culture for more of an embrace of free speech. Also joined by Myra Washington, who's an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of New Mexico, also got her PhD at the University of Illinois, and she signed a counter letter, as well as Anthony Fisher, a politics columnist for Business Insider, who's written on this subject. Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation at 800-222-9455. Has cancel culture, to the effect that phrase is still meaningful to people, has it gone too far? Is free speech at risk? And I wonder, do you see this play out in your personal lives? I mean, are you having tough conversations with friends and family, or are you avoiding them because you're worried about sort of a personal cancellation in your life? Again, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And I do want to mention a tweet from one of our listeners. Joel Johnson says, cancel culture has become a thing because the elite are experiencing consequences for tone deaf or prejudiced speech. On the other hand, minorities, people of color, have had the threat of being canceled by power forever, as your guests have shared. And we certainly have heard that perspective. Deirdre, I want to ask you, one of the criticisms of the letter is who has signed it. It was signed by, for example, Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who's been criticized for expressing views a lot of people say are transphobic. Another signer, Jesse Singal, wrote a big story raising questions about gender-affirming care for young people, which the objective letter characterized as writing derogatorily about trans issue. I mean, you've written a book about your journey as a transgender woman. I wonder, what do you make of that critique of the letter that you signed?
Well, you know, I don't like those opinions about transgendered folk, which are often badly informed. But I think the cure for being badly informed is to become informed. And the only way you become informed is if someone speaks to you. The problem here is dogma, self-isolating, wrong beliefs. As an American humorist long ago said, it's not what you don't know that hurts you. It's what you know that ain't so. And that's the problem here. And it's not confined to any group. We're often misunderstood by others. And others have opinions that are wrong. You know, yes, I'm a.
And I'm afraid we need to pause there to take a quick break. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking about free speech and open debate and this idea of cancel culture. Stay with us. More to come in a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to continue our conversation on free speech, debate, cancel culture, marginalized voices trying to assert themselves in public debate, and the question of whether is cancel culture one person's cancel culture is another person's attempt to hold powerful voices accountable for the things they say. And we're speaking with Deirdre Nansen McCloskey, emerita professor of economics, history, English, and communication at the University of Illinois Chicago; Myra Washington, who teaches professor of communication and journalism at the University of New Mexico; and Anthony Fisher, who's a politics columnist at Business Insider, has written on this issue. Myra Washington, I want to ask you, before the break, we heard this idea that, and I'm going to paraphrase from memory here, but the idea that, you know, the cure to wrong, to ignorant speech is more speech, right? And I wonder what you make of what we were hearing before the break, that this idea that, even if people have wrongheaded views who sign the letter, that the point of it is to encourage more debate. I think Malcolm Gladwell was quoted when he was asked about sort of the company you keep question. He said, I thought the point of signing the letter was that I would be signing it with people with whom I disagree. I'm paraphrasing there, but I wonder what you make of those arguments.
Yeah, I think that for me, that would maybe be more persuasive if we didn't exist in a country that has always denigrated these sorts of differences and has continued to marginalize people who don't agree with sort of the dogma, I think was the word that maybe Anthony had used, or maybe Deidre. So it has never been equally about listening to speech from all sides. And I think that's the problem. And is that here in the rebuttal letter, and I think for most people, it has never been about suppressing what people can say, but has instead been like, here are other alternative takes, here are other views, here are other people, here are the people who are impacted by the very thing that you're saying, and we don't like what you're saying, and so here's why. And I think Anthony said that, you know, these people had never suffered consequences. I didn't say that, right? I said that they had not been canceled. And so his examples were all people, women, people of color, who had faced consequences for what they said, right? So, you know, against patriarchy or about race, all of these things. And that is kind of my point, is that the punishments have been unequally distributed to people who are already on the outskirts, already marginalized, less powerful, not in positions to sort of do the things that they want to do, and instead can only use their words. But their words are not equally accepted by other folks.
I agree.
And I wonder, Myra, do you see a difference between, you know, on the one hand, you know, being critiqued on Twitter by people you respect? I mean, that can be awful feeling, as you know, I'm sure many of us have experienced criticism from colleagues and peers and people we respect. But is something, do you see that as different from losing a job? Or do you think, well, you know, this is the era, you know, this you just need to think thoroughly about what you say, and the people that have lost jobs, they're going to be okay. So it's not such a big deal.
Oh, no, I see it for sure as very different. And I get it, like feeling public shamed, feeling badly, getting ratioed on Twitter are all terrible, horrible things, but those are also feelings, right? And how does that compare to this sort of tangible material impact of being fired or not being hired or being told you can't cover a story, you know, or being told that you can't be here or being told you can't play in the NFL. So all of those things, I think about the tangible, the material versus your feelings. And I think that, yes, those are definitely two very different things. But I also think that part of the issue that I have with cancel culture is it is an individual thing. So I think Thomas Chatterton Williams, who started it, was like, yeah, we can transcend race on an interpersonal level. And I think that's part of the problem, is that with cancel culture, we focus on one person and not the system that produces it, or the system that allows, you know, this behavior to continue, or the system that continues to keep people out or gatekeep or oppress or suppress. And that is where I think part of the responses to these people really come in handy. So talking to someone on Twitter and saying you're not happy with the thing that they said is part of this resistance, but it doesn't quite get to the systemic level that I hope for us to get to. And so that is my only sort of agreement with the letter writers, is that they are calling for more of an addressing of the issues, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. And Anthony, I want to ask you, and maybe we can kind of start to wind down this conversation here. But, you know, my initial reaction to this was, and I mean, initial when it first happened, was like, oh, goodness, this is going to be one of these elite fights that happens on Twitter and, you know, doesn't necessarily strike a chord in the broader world, right? Because Twitter, as much as it is a place where politicians and journalists and academics have a lot of heated conversation sometimes, it is still a relatively small slice of at least America who is on there and thinking about these things. And so I guess I kind of want to take a step back, but obviously this has blown up into a broader conversation now. And so I want to sort of bring the conversation maybe out of the academy, out of the press, to the everyday world where most people live their lives. And Anthony, I wonder, what do you see as the stakes for everyone else in this conversation?
I think it's a good question. There was one particular example, even though I came across this example via Twitter. It's an example of something happening outside of academia and outside of the media. It was a New York City Educational Council meeting, and one of its members screamed, completely upset, that another member had briefly held his friend's black nephew, I think, on his lap during a video call. And the one member yelled to the other that was problematic, and that if he didn't understand why it was problematic, he needs to read Robin DiAngelo's book or Ibram Kendi's book. And okay, that's an argument. I'm not saying that, you know, that she wasn't genuinely upset, but what I worry about is someone reading these books and saying, I take issue with this particular idea in this book, or I don't like this book at all. I think this book is bad. I think these ideas are bad. I do wonder if these quote unquote elite arguments, when they, you know, get down to the granular level and start dealing with, you know, the lives of regular people, if there's going to be certain ideas and certain dissents that will be just considered beyond the pale. And I think that this particular video that went public is kind of an example of that.
Okay. And I think we're gonna have to leave this conversation there. There's obviously a lot more we can have, and I'm sure we will continue revisiting the debate on free speech and who gets to talk and who has access to the media and academia in the future. I want to thank our guests. We've been speaking with Anthony Fisher, who's a political columnist for Business Insider, Myra Washington, associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of New Mexico, and author of Blasian Invasion, Racial Mixing of the Celebrity Industrial Complex, excuse me, and Deirdre Nansen McCloskey, who is a emerita professor of economics, history, English, and communication at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and the author of many books, including most recently, Why Liberalism Works, How True Liberal Values Produce a Freer, More Equal, Prosperous World for All. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.